Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Why are you following me?
The stuff you wear is inappropriate for what you're planning on doing.
You don't know anything about me. I'm ready.
You're not. And none of the stuff that you're thinking means anything anyway.
Never kissed anyone before.
Hello, and welcome back to Still Watching. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
What we do every week on Still Watching, if you are unfamiliar, is we take some piece of television that is currently airing that Richard and I are interested in. We watch an episode a week and we talk about it. That's what we do. We are who we are. That's what we're
exactly.
Watching. And that's who we are. So here we are. This is episode 2 of our coverage of the HBO miniseries We Are Who We Are, brought to you by the great Luca Guadagnino, among other people. And we are here to talk about episode 2. We will not be spoiling anything beyond episode 2. I haven't watched beyond episode 2, so that's a good guarantee I won't be discussing beyond the episode itself. I forgot to mention this last week, returning from hiatus, we have an email, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. I completely forgot to mention it, but if you are watching along with us, and you have questions or comments or concerns, we would love to hear from you. stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Some of our greatest insights have come from our emails, and I would be particularly interested to know if anyone, like, either currently in the military or has served in the military, is watching the show and sort of what they think of this depiction of military life or military adjacent life in the show.
Or if any of you are Chloe Sevigny, I'd love to hear from you too.
Yes. If you're Chloe Sevigny, I would really appreciate an email. I've been waiting, Chloe, and now's your time. So we're here to talk about episode 2, which is titled Right Here, Right Now, number 2. Each episode of the season is titled Right Here, Right Now with a number associated with it. If our entry into this world of American families on an Italian military base came through the character of Frasier, played by Jack Dylan Grazer. This week's episode serves as sort of a companion piece, a Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, what happened on the other side narration through the eyes of Caitlin/Harper, whatever we want to call them, played by Jordan Christine Simon, I think is the last name. I was poking around Jordan's website, and they go by JK on their website. So that's just, I don't know. I might wind up calling them JK if that's they make music, really interesting. Every young person on a show now has like 9 other side hustles going on, and I'm like, all right, guys, you could just.
But yeah, they're the good JK right now.
yes, the one we want to follow. We also meet Harper's family. We've got Danny, the older brother, Richard, the father, and Jenny, who we already met significantly last week, the mother. So that's Faith Alabi as Jenny, Scott Mascuti as Richard, and Spence Moore the second as Danny. And I really liked this episode a lot. And it actually, like, a lot of my tension around the character of Frasier dissolved significantly with his peripheral actions in this episode. How did, like, before we get into this other family, how did Frasier sit for you this week?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there might have been some worry from me included about the first episode that it was going to be yet another thing where this kind of, you know, magical, weird character enters this very stifled world and, you know, changes everyone's minds about who they are and, you know, like kind of a Pleasantville riff or something like that. Right. Because, you know, this is a very ordered place. It's a military base. Mm-hmm. There's also, you know, there is the wildness of Italy surrounding the base, but I think what this episode kind of subverts in that sense is that, like, no, there's a ton of interesting, you know, divergent, idiosyncratic things that were happening before he arrived. And so he's entering into a busy world rather than kind of creating that busyness.
Right.
Which I think is a delicate way to handle these kind of narratives because so often, it's one bright character sort of enlivening all the drab people around them. And that's not the case here, obviously.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I hadn't thought of it in that way. But yeah, I think it feels like, and the way these episodes are positioned as sort of, you know, companion pieces, it really does feel like two interesting, curious, unsettled kids, and who settled at this age, finding each other. And that's something I want to keep watching. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think there's something particularly persuasive about the way that the show is starting to draw these connections between people who are grappling with identity in some form or another, be it gender expression, sexuality, whatever they're kind of contending with as young people, with the fact that they live itinerant lives.
Yeah.
And this kind of notion of, like, how do you ground yourself? How do you find yourself when everything surrounding you shifts every couple of years and is sort of always in doubt? I think it's a really interesting kind of terrarium, to set the show in, because it's so impermanent. And yet the things these people are realizing about themselves may eventually become a sort of permanent piece of identity, despite their surroundings.
Yeah. Not just itinerant, but like, itinerant, and also set, as you mentioned already, on the backdrop of something so regimented. You know what I mean? Like, this idea of, like, trying to figure out your identity on a military base where the idea of individuality is, you know, frowned upon. You know what I mean? Like, we'll get to the MAGA hats a bit more, but, like, even this idea of, like, okay, well, we can't wear these outside because that's an expression of our, you know, political belief, but we can wear them around the house. You know what I mean? So you can't be an individual out and about on the base. You have to, like, go to the fringes of town or, you know, something like that in order to be able to do that. So, and something that I think is interesting, I mean, like, sure, why not? Let's talk about the politics. Cause, like, I was a little bit, I was warned is the wrong word, but I was,
Tipped off,
sure. to the fact that Trump was sort of going to be percolating the background of this story by our colleague Sonia Soraya, who reviewed the show for for VF.com. And so the fact that this series takes place during the 2016 election, apparently we're going to get some, like, Clinton stuff too. You know, is, despite the fact that I was tipped off, I still, my, like, my jaw dropped and my shoulders hunched, like, when the Trump ad starts playing. And what's interesting is, like, we see that ad, you know, Harper's there with her father, and, like, we see the ad, and they sit up and pay attention and, like, turn around and watch it. But we're unclear at that point what their feelings are around Trump. It's only later we see the MAGA hats. And so, you know, and I've also been tipped off with the fact that this isn't like a super overtly political show, but that, you know, the realities of American politics are going to be simmering in the background of this human drama.
Yeah, and the strangeness of being in a foreign country, even though they keep saying the base is America, but being so governed by this thing happening thousands of miles away in a literal sense, because this is the U.S. military running this base, commanding where these people and their families go at any given year.
Right.
So there's that obvious connection, but there's also just the sort of the larger sense of just how America looms over the world. And, to be dealing with all of your own private, you know, excitements and turmoils and all that stuff, while also the world seems to be tilting towards something, very different, let's say. I mean, I don't know who, some people would find it frightening on the show, so others not. Obviously, Scott, you know, the father, Scott Mascuti's character, doesn't. But I do like the bit with the hats. Yeah. Where it just doesn't fit on Harper's head.
Right.
Like,
right.
That's such a nice little, I mean, obvious, maybe visual metaphor for like, I don't know if Harper is really going to go that route, even though their father is clearly all in.
Right. Especially when Harper's wearing like a different ball cap later. So it's like, you can, a ball cap could work if we really tried. Yeah, and what they're setting up, I think, is interesting in terms of like the personal wages of, you know, the Trump rise, because if we look at this family, like, you know, we start with Harper and their dad on this like early morning, this special thing they share. They have all these special things that they share. Their relationship seems really lovely, really close. But if you think about like Harper's questions around their gender identity or their sexuality, whatever it may be, might be unfriendly to a MAGA father. The fact that Danny, the brother, seems to, from the context clues that I could glean in this episode, seems to maybe be thinking about Islam as like a religion that he mm-hmm. might be interested in. Mm-hmm. And then you've got a mother longing for like Chicago, a black mother longing for Chicago, you know what I mean? A non-American born mother longing for Chicago, which just like, you know, inspires Obama to me. You know, I'm sure there are Trump supporters who live in Chicago. So like, it just seems like, it, you know, if this father goes all in on Trump, I think it's no coincidence that the ad that plays is about the like Muslim ban, you know, and how that might directly impact any kind of relationship he might have with his son. And so, you know, just thinking about like, how is this man's support of Trump going to potentially fracture his relationships with everyone in his family, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think it further emboldens the interesting nature of this project in that, there's a term of art that a lot of kids who grow up abroad and traveling around a lot use. It's something generation kids, I forget. That they're seeing a bit more or a lot more of the world than your typical American kid is. And yet they're still tied to America and, trying to form a sort of sense of relationship to that country, despite not having any real geographical allegiance to it. And I think that, I don't know, in some ways reflects the way that a lot of younger generations within the borders of the United States feel about their country, which is like, I live here and I'm part of it. Yeah. But like nothing about it, at least in terms of who wields the levers of power and how they wield them, reflects my own experience that I live, you know, with my friends or online at school. And so I feel like this is just a really heightened way of getting at a lot of feelings of displacement and just generational alienation that I think a lot of young people are experiencing now. Absolutely. For better and worse, you know, I mean, I think that in the better sense, like you see so much like activism coming out of younger generations, such a new awareness and a better awareness of social justice issues and all those things. But also in the day to day of your life, that can probably feel really chafing and kind of lonely, to not really be able to look up generationally and see much that you can either recognize or aspire to.
Yeah. And it, you know, it's an interesting, it's an interesting turn on a trope that we might be really familiar with, which is like a rebellious army brat who like doesn't get along with their conservative father. And it's like, no, that's not what we're being served here. It's like, this is a young teen who's very, very, very close to their father. And yeah. I just feel like I see like disaster looming on the horizon.
And close to him in a way that would seem to connect to Harper's experimentation with like gender presentation and stuff like that. You know, these kind of secretive morning missions that what were they doing?
Selling gasoline?
It was gasoline? Like? Okay. Yeah. Which is probably not above board in terms of, the dad's position in the military. But like there is this kind of, you know, stereotypically male ritual about it. Like the father waking his son up and they go hunting, you know, at the crack of dawn or whatever, and watching Harper like eagerly participate in that. And then later in the episode being brought further into that connected fold with the MAGA hats and maybe a little bit finding the limits of their allegiance to their dad's whole worldview, you know?
Right. And the fact that he got two hats, you know, and so
not one for the brother, not one for mom, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, it's very, you're very clearly watching like a, this is, you know, and this happens in families, like this is the child I connect with. And you're right that like usually we're used to seeing like that's the father and son. But like Danny, who has a lot of things going on with Danny in this episode, like, you know, does not seem to connect with his father in any way. And, you know, and so what's looped into that as part of, you know, Harper's questions around gender and their own body is, you know, is this moment when they get their period, which to me brought me up short because I thought we were dealing with older teens, but I think they're supposed to be like 14.
They're like freshmen.
Yeah. For some reason, I thought they were like sophomores or juniors, but
well, I think they're played by older kids.
Right.
Which doesn't help. It's like,
but I felt like my naivete like sort of hit me because I'm like, okay. You know, there's a lot that happens around this, like the arrival of Harper's period, but this conversation with Scott Muscudi's character where he's like, it's natural. It's the hormones. It's natural, you know, and he's like, this is what a female, you know, and it's so like on the surface, it's just an incredibly like supportive, nice thing for a dad to say, you know, to his daughter, like, you know, it's natural. It's fine. This kid doesn't feel like they can talk to their mom about it. So they come to their dad and he like gives a, he's not like, talk to your mom about it. He's like, it's natural. It's fine. It's great. It's fine. But like, we as the audience know that like this may not feel natural for this kid.
Right.
This expression of like, you know, female biology. And, you know, that's just, it sits on top of what should feel like a really nice, father-child conversation, you know?
Yeah. And I think that there is some excitement about like Harper kind of reaching this, you know, rite of passage of a sense, in the way that they talk to a friend, you know, I forget the character's name, Scorsese's daughter.
Right.
About it, you know, and there's kind of like a, oh, like welcome or whatever, congratulations. And so like, and that makes sense because it would be probably a complicated reaction, you know, it wouldn't just be one thing or another. And, you know, and I think that that kind of speaks to my initial sort of wariness about the structure of the episode, which is to go back in time and to see these first days of Fraser's being on the base, but through this very different perspective in which Fraser is only limitedly included. And I was like, well, we're kind of repeating a lot of mundane stuff, kids just having quiet conversations on the beach or wandering around looking at things. Right. But I think that what it ultimately does is show that like from 20 feet away, a person on the beach with their friends might just be seen like totally settled and contented and in their place. And yet zoom in a little bit, walk up to them that 20 feet and there's a whole riot of things going on in their life. And, we don't really know what we see in terms of like a charged glance across a beach. So I think that even though the stuff we're reliving is a little bit prosaic, it's still, it means quite a bit to Harper.
Right. And that's something that it endears Frasier to me more, this idea of really seeing someone, even from afar, like that he sees what's going on here. So, Francesca Scorsese's character's name is Brittany. I think we talked about this off air. We were going to talk about it on air, but like, do you want to run down all the people who are related to people who are on the show?
Well, we've got our lead who is, the lead in the first episode anyway, who's Brian Grazer, this mega producer partner of Ron Howard, his nephew. We've got Francesca Scorsese, and Alice Braga, who plays one of the two mothers of Frasier, is the great Brazilian legend Sonia Braga's niece. There's a lot of
some legacy going on here.
Legacy. I don't want to call it nepotism, but you know, it's something adjacent to that maybe. But I think the interesting thing about that is, in a weird way, this is, not in a weird way, in a plain way, this is a show about some kids dealing with the very, potent and pertinent legacy of their parents. Their parents are in the military, and there's all of this kind of attendant reverence and rigidity, associated with that. And these are kids just, you know, who have been dragged along by their parents' lives or their families' lives, and their legacies, and are now just trying to like scratch out some kind of individual existence for themselves. And so maybe some of these kids, you know, only one is a direct descendant of a famous person, but, maybe they can relate to that in some way.
Yeah, that's a great point. It is kind of wild. I like completely missed that Brittany is played by Francesca Scorsese until you mentioned it to me last week, and then just like watching her this week, and I was like, I can barely see it. I barely see it.
Well, she's so blonde. It's just like it doesn't track with the Scorsese image, you know, in your head.
It's true. I'm like, where are her heavy rimmed glasses? I really need those to help me out here.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
Anyway, I wanted to talk to you about something we talked about last week, was this idea of like how immersive Luca Guadagnino properties feel sensually. And by that, I mean like the senses, in addition to like sexual, whatever, immersive. And something that really caught my notice even more in this episode than it did in the first episode is the sound design and the way that the sound, and obviously that's not purely like on Luca. And I have some names I can shout out just one second if I call them up, but that it's the trick of putting you in someone's headphones isn't like exactly novel and new to this, but you know, it's not just the headphones and like what's coming out of them, it's also like the other music in this episode. So Robin Erdang is the name of the music supervisor, and Devante Hines is doing the original music. And I think this episode starts with an original piece of music that is like kind of avant-garde, and it really just sort of put me inside this whole world really quickly.
Yeah.
I was wondering if like the sound of the music had hit you in that way.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really digging. I don't know if it's Devante Hines writing these or if these are extant pieces of work that, you know, predate the show, but like these lilting kind of piano things that are reminiscent of the opening credits of Call Me By Your Name, that give the scenes, like, you know, I'm thinking of Harper on the bus, you know, just kind of part of their long day, kind of having a little moment to think, looking out the window of the bus. The way that music is melancholy and hopeful and playful and, you know, but a little sad and propulsive, but also kind of has a little kind of elegiac rhythm to it. Like it's so perfectly, maybe from an adult perspective, maybe you don't feel this way when you're actually living it as a kid, but like from my perspective, it so perfectly captures like that mix of I don't know, melancholy and excitement about that age. Like, it's weird to be getting older. It's exciting to be getting older. You don't really know where you fit. But and then all the stuff with the headphones on, headphones off. Like, I think it's clear that Guadagnino has an idea that I think is probably pretty accurate, that kids, especially now, are living this kind of bifurcated or double lives. One that's sort of the interiority of the things they're listening to, the things they're looking at their phone, and then the rest is the outside world. Oh, well, I guess three if you count what's in their head. And I think to kind of literalize that way, is really interesting and, smart. And I think gives a kind of another layer of consciousness to, this show, which is already sort of speaking in these sort of mysteriously wispy tones.
Something that I found interesting, and I'd have to go back and rewatch to make sure it's correct, but I feel like Frasier is in his headphones. That's not a real phrase. It's just something I've decided to say. But in the world of the immersive music, most of all when he's outside the house, when he's wandering around. And Harper, I think, mostly has it inside their house. I was noticing when Harper takes a long bus ride, they don't have music on. There's a score, and then they're sort of listening to the outside world. I don't know if that's intentional or if I just made it up, but I just thought it was kind of interesting. And this idea of Frasier and Harper both being people who are maybe marching to a slightly different beat than other folks, but Harper being able at this point to pass into a circle of friends, to be dating, it appears to me to be multiple boys, and then Frasier just looking out the window, to paraphrase a musical that both of us don't like, just sort of observing from afar, you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. And I think the other thing about it is that when I was presented, when the idea of a Luca Guadagnino series was presented to me, I was like, that's a lot of hours to spend in his, right. Oral and visual assaults. All of his films have this kind of really towering kind of aesthetic, wall coming at you. But he reins in, when necessary. But then will kind of splash us into this kind of big music cue that really works. And I don't know. I mean, the show, it's a hard show for our podcast because it doesn't have a ton of narrative shape to it. But as a kind of different experience of watching a series as we head into the fall where there's going to be more, traditionally linear shows, I'm finding it a nice sort of, antechamber. We're in a nice kind of warm bath before we plunge in fully. And that's probably partly the intended effect.
Yeah, Ben Travers over at IndieWire has this great notion in his review about it being the perfect end of summer, sort of. We're pretty much in fall, but this does feel like a Dog Days of Summer kind of show. And also, I mean, he said something kind of poetic about, the end of America summer. You know what I mean? If you think about the Trump administration looming, and I thought that was interesting. But I did want to one thing. Yeah. So I went around and read everyone's reviews because I was just interested to hear what our friends and colleagues thought of the show. And the point that came up over and over again was this idea that this show is doing a similar thing to Euphoria, which is something you and I talked about a bit last week. But without something that was mentioned over and over again was but without the really scary parent alienating edge that Euphoria had. And I was at the, I think that it was the premiere of Euphoria at the Austin Television Festival last year. And that was last year. Time, what a weird thing. And, there were parents there in the audience who got up in the mic and were concerned and stressed out by what they had seen. But I feel like that narrative kind of went away, or am I being naive? Is that the lingering take on Euphoria that it was scare the parents, like, sort of show? What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I came to Euphoria late, sort of during quarantine, well after the buzz had kind of blown through. Mm-hmm. To me, that show feels like a distillation or a sort of example for both the generation it's about and generations that are parenting that generation about, like, what's going on in that world. And whether it's kind of cautionary or celebratory or both or not, I think that what works so well about Euphoria is that it's not wagging its finger in any direction, really, you know. Maybe at certain characters, sure, but... and with this show, in the way that it relates to that, like, it's challenging in a different way. I think it's challenging in the first episode where Fraser's kind of like this doing some strange things that are hard to sort of reconcile. And in this episode, it refuses to, we were talking about it last week, like, it refuses to do the thing that comes so knee jerk and badly for me, which is like label.
Right.
Who is this show about? How does Harper identify? Like, what are their, you know, what's their trajectory on this show? And then what I think that Guadagnino is doing with not just the way that the characters are written, but also with, and he's, you know, has co-writers, but with the music and the direction is kind of giving body to that fluidity. And I think in some way, if you can drag a sort of reluctant parent in front of the sofa to watch a show like this, they might see, in contrast to Euphoria, a gentler approach to, the sort of vagaries of, like, you know, younger than Gen Z. Which is, like, you know, I think the show could have an instructive value. But it's just less, like, I don't know, overt about its, you know, this is the youth themes than Euphoria is.
It's interesting. Like, I guess I technically am old enough to have, like, a teen kid, but I don't feel like, I don't, like, if I started really young, I could have a teen right now. But, like, I don't feel like of the generation that are parents to the teenagers now, but I am obviously, like, well removed from teenagedom. And I thought Euphoria just presented so much opportunity for empathy for, like, the really stressful world these kids live in. I mean, maybe if I were an actual parent, I would be too stressed to be able to access that empathy. Anyway, I just didn't, I was sort of, like, pushing back on the, I don't know, categorization of Euphoria as this, like, shock the parents. I was like,
yeah,
I don't think that's what they were going for at all.
Well,
you know?
I think the shock the parents thing is like so reductive because it's like, oh, but can something not be about parent, like, you know, like,
yeah,
like, you know,
yeah.
Sure, you can watch it and you can react to it, but, like, that's a show that HBO is expressly pitching toward the audience it's made about, you know. Whereas I feel like We Are Who We Are does slightly have that sort of dreamier haze of nostalgia to it.
Yeah.
It's not as immediate and pertinent in some ways. So I'll be curious to see, like, I mean, cause I feel like We Are Who We Are is setting up certain tensions, obviously between Harper and their father, but also I think between, the father and Chloe Sevigny's character, because there seemed to be some barely expressed resentment during the swearing in ceremony in the first episode. And it was like, maybe they were passed over or something like that. So I don't know if that's good. I don't think they're setting up like a, you know, Capulet Montague thing here, but I feel like the kind of the power dynamic of the base presumably will have to come to bear on the kids,
right?
Because that's part of the reason it's set there, I would think.
Well, yeah, it's you know, in a much like more harmless way, Harper referred to Fraser's family as like the aliens, the aliens landed sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like, you know, they're outsiders in a way that stretches beyond just being new on base. And I think that has to do with, like, you know, two women being at the head of this family. And we will see how that unfolds, or just a woman being in charge, in general. So we'll see.
I like the brief moment when, Jenny, the mom,
yeah,
is sitting on the couch watching the Chicago weather, which I wonder also, given the, now we know the time frame of the series, it's like 2016. If if the Chicago thing has to do with Obama partly.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Okay.
Some Obama, but anyway, nostalgia sort of.
Yeah, exactly. And, yeah. But I like it because it is 20. It's the first Trump election, right? Like,
yes.
That's the, okay.
I thought it was like because of the Muslim ban thing. I thought it was like he's already been elected, but I read some reviews that said like this is we'll get a clearer indication that this is like during the campaign,
right? Basically. Right, like the fall of 2016,
right?
The fall in that's a uh-huh. many meaning. But anyway, Jenny is sitting on the couch and she says hi to who she calls Kate.
Yeah.
And is like, oh, I met the new commander, blah, blah, blah. And then there's a slight pause and she says, and her wife, like in, and she says it cheerily, like she's not, you know, and even her reaction to the couple in the first episode, like she's obviously like, you know, is trying in good faith and being welcoming and whatever. But that tension of the fact that like the commander is a lesbian and has her wife on base, like I feel like and the way that the people around the base react to that would also have to come to inform the way that Harper and Fraser like process their own shit, you know.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
And so I think that they're setting up a sort of delicate parallel in some ways,
yeah,
which is interesting.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, to circle back to the like question of how immersive is this story, is you know, we had a lot of discussion about Fraser and the camera and like maybe trying too hard to define, you know, me as like a square elder millennial / Gen Xer trying to like define his sexuality by where the camera was lingering and trying to understand it. And then us sort of concluding that like maybe not boxing him is sort of the point. But like what I thought was interesting is I didn't feel like like the camera did the same thing with the Harper POV. Like, I don't feel like I got like a lingering appreciation of female or male bodies. And to me that speaks to like, just a discomfort. I don't know. That's my interpretation of it. So,
yeah, no, and even the way that like bodies are spoken about to Harper, and like the whole thing, like, did you touch it? Did you feel it at least? Like, and then you know, they're kind of hooking up with that boy at school, and there's that kind of forced intimacy that because maybe that's like what they think should be happening, you know.
Right.
So there's a tentativeness, yeah, that would seem to speak to something going on internally, that's different from what's going on with Fraser. I feel like we also maybe forgot to mention in the first episode about the first episode is this friend Mark that Fraser has been sort of sending missives to, right?
Oh,
did
right.
we talk about that? And he
no.
says, I love you at the end of
right.
these messages.
Right.
Very, it's very Felicity with the, you know, what was the friend's name? Alice?
I'll remember it. Hold on.
Yeah. But so that sets
Sally,
up an interesting,
Sally,
thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
I knew it was a Allie sound. That sets up an interesting thing of like, you know, again, kind of speaking to like how, you know, old and crusty and rigid I am. It's like, well, maybe maybe he partly already has things figured out and maybe Harper does too. And we're just sort of like catching up. Who knows? You know, my guess, given the way that like Call Me By Your Name was so sort of ambiguous about its sexuality, is that this show will probably not present us with any neatly ascribed thing by the end. But I do get more of the sense that we are coming in very much in medias res of these characters' journeys,
right.
Not at the beginning of them.
Absolutely. Like, it doesn't feel like that was the very, very, very first time Harper went out, like, in her dad's, in their dad's shirt or whatever. But there was opportunity, like, in that cafe, when Fraser is like getting his beer, not red wine, in the background, there was opportunity for like the camera to sort of like linger on these girls who were like, you know, flirting, and it didn't. And I just thought that
yeah.
was interesting, you know, given the way the camera moved in the first episode. So that was just something I thought.
I also liked in that scene. I don't think we saw it in the first episode. Harper's left and Fraser's sitting there. And the counter lady is out from behind the counter, and she's like, "Hey, Blondie, do you want another beer?" And he looks kind of surprised, and it's like, "Yeah, you're in Italy. They'll give you another beer."
But also, I think he just doesn't speak Italian, so he's just like, "What are you offering me?" He's just like so lost. Meanwhile, Harper is dropping like multiple languages, and that's just another thing. The other thing about the camera is like something I didn't pick up on, but I probably should have in the first couple episodes, is this idea that like Fraser is like, if not like a fashion design, I mean, like I could tell by his clothing that of course he's like interested in fashion, but I think there might be like further, storyline around like, that he's like some kind of amateur designer or something like that, that's an interest of his, a passion of his. And, you know, you can connect that to the clothing that, he leaves for Harper.
Right.
But in that way, it might also make sense for the camera when it's in his POV to be lingering almost equally on male and female bodies, because like, he's not just sexually interested in them. He's also like, fashion and bodies and like how that works together, that's of interest to me, which is something that hadn't occurred to me.
The term that I was looking for earlier is third culture kid.
Oh, okay.
Which the third refers to like their birth cult, their parents' birth culture and their adopted culture where they live, that kind of melds into a third thing. Which you clearly see happening on this show. Right. You know, I think the way that you know, what Italy presents, its kind of looseness, its sensuality, but also its restrictions. I mean, this is still a very Catholic country, blah, blah, blah. Like, it still has very, you know, there are parts of Italy that have pretty rigid gender roles, you know. So I don't know. I think it'll be interesting to see, like, how much of the Italianness seeps into everything as well as the, you know, as much as the military stuff does.
So, what's interesting to me, and this might not become, we might not be able to solve this based on the two episodes we've seen, but like, so, Harper is dating Sam, like most overtly. Sam's the one they hooked up with on the beach, made out with at school, blah, blah. But then there's also this character of Craig, who, is Sam's older brother, though I don't know how like crystal clear that was, in the episode. But he's the one who keeps like kissing Harper on the face.
Yeah.
Like slightly more paternally, but still like more than I would want, you know, my brother kissing my, you know, partner. So I don't really know what's going on there. Do you have any like insight that I missed?
I don't, but I think it does mirror in some ways this little jolt of attraction, it would seem, that Fraser had toward the naked soldier he saw in the shower, where there obviously is this like probably pretty firm line about people on the base not, you know, canoodling with the children of other soldiers. Right. Especially commanding officers. Right. Especially when those children are 14 or 15 years old.
Right.
Especially. But like, obviously, if you have like 19-year-old soldiers and like 15-year-old kids, like or 16-year-old, whatever, that's going to be a dynamic on base, obviously, you know?
Right.
And I think it would be weird if the show didn't kind of gesture toward that. I don't really know what's going on between Harper and the soldier in that scene. It kind of caught me off. I was like, oh, I don't really know what's happening here.
Yeah.
But I think, I mean, maybe it was just meant to be that like Harper's searching for something that feels right, you know,
right.
And, hasn't found it. And, is, you know, like a lot of kids do, is just like kind of knocking on a lot of doors at once, and seeing which ones open. So yeah, I don't know. I think, you know, in a more traditional TV narrative way, the show is setting up some romantic entanglements and, you know, whatever. And that, you know, it'll be fun to watch those kind of sort themselves out. And I don't know. I mean, do you feel like after two episodes, and it's hard to say because we're now back to kind of the present that the first episode ended at.
Right.
Do you feel like this show is setting up Harper and Fraser to have a romantic relationship, or do you think it's just going to be that they have a deep sense of understanding each other, as like fellow travelers?
I think it's the latter.
Yeah.
I think platonic is what it's aiming for, but we'll see. You know what I mean? Yeah. What do you think?
No, I mean, I hope it's the latter. I would be interested in the former, obviously, because it would reflect a very like, it would be a non-traditional relationship, I guess. But I'm more attracted to a story of, kids helping each other without that kind of added incentive or whatever. Yeah. And sort of bouncing off of each other and maybe, you know, who knows, getting in fights or whatever, but like both kind of coming up together in a way.
Yeah. No, I would love that. Like empathy and support and connection. what a concept.
Doesn't sound nice. Well, when of course all of that is about to leave the world in about a few weeks after this show takes place.
Right. So the other thing I wanted to mention in terms of like sound design, is this moment where Harper is reading, I think poetry, but reading, sort of just like sitting tucked in a corner of a street somewhere and overhearing, basically these soldiers talk about, gang raping, a woman, was my interpretation of what I heard. You know, she's not like focusing too much on it. She seems to be like intently trying to focus on the book, but that's just like, I just think that's a really interesting thing to put in the back. You know, one of our listeners, I saw them express some trepidation around like, I'm not sure how interested I am in a show that's set in a military base. And I was like, well, what I can promise you is Luca Guadagnino is not like, yay, US military. So like in the first episode, we get this moment in the like sort of flag ceremony or whatever it was, where the outgoing commanding officer was like, good luck, been a lot of rape, sexual assault and suicide on the base here. Have fun with that. And then here, yeah, we hear them talk about like, you know, this Italian woman saying no, three men going at her at once. And then he says, I heard the line, you know, excuse the slur that I'm about to say, like all these WAPs are whores, meaning all these Italian women like really want it or something like that. So like, and that's all part of the like stew that these kids are growing up in, you know what I mean? It's just mm-hmm. that's just like casual conversation in the background of like Harper doing their homework basically, and I just thought that was interesting because like it's pretty it could have been much more ham-fistedly done, but I like the way that it's so background, because it just it in a chilling way normalizes it, I guess. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I don't want to overgeneralize, but obviously there is stuff on military bases that's terrible, and it's one of the most pervasive problems in the military, and that would be palpably felt on any base.
Right.
At the same time, would a kid, especially who's not in the military, be feeling and absorbing that every second of the day? And not caught up in their own, you know, and I mean, they don't mean this in a pejorative way, self-involvement and there's, you know, like,
right.
I think it would lap at the edges and then maybe insist itself in at times, but I don't think it would be like the only kind of reality of the life there.
I completely agree. And that was beautifully said, lap at the edges and insist its way in. But like that, that's what I mean. Well, I don't know how to say this without it sounding like I'm using intentional language here, but like, it's not a constant assault. It's just sort of like it's just vapor. You know what I mean? But like, growing up in like a poisonous vapor is still going to poison you. You know what I mean? So.
Right. Well, yeah, exactly. I don't mean to imply. Yeah. I mean, obviously, like, something that bad is going to affect everything.
Right.
And I think that the show, I don't think it's evasive for the show to introduce it subtly.
Yeah.
I guess maybe that's really what I was saying, is that it's more realistic that this would be sort of an absorbed thing through osmosis and overheard things.
Yeah.
And I mean, but it could come to, you know, it could become a much bigger part of the series. We don't know. I mean, that's, you know, one of the interesting things about you and I not watching ahead.
Yeah, for once. All right. Is there anything else you want to talk about in terms of, this episode?
What did you make of the gift of the shirt and the pants?
I don't know. Like, for me, so, like, you know, Fraser seems to be saying, like, you know, if you want to pass, your clothes are wrong for that. And then he sent over what looked to be, like, his clothing. And the shirt is, like, a little bit more fitted. And the pants are boycott pants. And I just took the act of Harper putting them on and him seeing them on as like a, I see you, I want to help you in whatever this is. I would like to help and support you. And Harper, like, accepting that help and support. That was my interpretation. What do you feel?
Yeah. And I think it lends more likelihood to are imagining that this is a show about that kind of mutual support and whatever. And Harper sees Fraser watching from the window, and yet there's nothing creepy about it. It seems supportive. It seems, you know, it's a form of communication. And that Harper so readily is like, yeah, I'm gonna put the outfit on. Like, I thought that they were gonna, like, be like, oh, weird, and toss it out, and, like, it would there kind of as this thing. But no, it's the opposite. So it's like a nice, not peace offering, because there's no discord between them, but some sort of offering. And I like that.
Yeah. Just like an I see you, and then, like, I accept that you see me and you're right, sort of thing. You're right about what you think you see here.
Right. But we're not going to say any more about it. We're not going to be like, you know, I'm not going to, you know, open the window and be like, hey, you know, it's more just a quiet sort of acknowledgement. Yeah.
But it helps inform the end of last week's episode, which I believe ended with Fraser being like, so what do I call you?
Right. Yeah.
And that's just much more loaded this time, like, knowing that they've had this exchange probably before they had that conversation of what do I call you, sort of, you know, informs. And then Harper was like, call me by my name.
Right.
and then Suspiria. Anyway, okay. So, did we do it? Episode 2?
Yeah, I think we've said all we can say.
We did it. Okay. So, once again, you can email us stillwatchingpod@gmail.com if you have any, questions, or observations about the episodes. Richard, where else can folks find you?
On VF.com and Twitter @Rylaws. And, I do sell gasoline, on one of the canals in Venice, but I'm kind of hard to find. So just ask a friend. Where will you be until next week, Joanna?
Well, you find me at VanityFair.com. You follow me on Twitter @JoeWroteThis. You will absolutely not find me midnight ziplining, daytime ziplining, any time of the week ziplining. No, that's not for me. So, and we will see you all next week.
Ciao.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.